WFAE reported how hospital emergency rooms are on the front lines of North Carolina's mental health crisis. In this installment of our series Fractured, we look at how jail staff are also on the front lines, even though they're often not adequately trained to tend to people with severe mental illness. Dana Miller-Irvin reports how the responsibility takes a toll on both jails and the people who work in them.
At 11:22 in the morning on June 16th, a receptionist at the Bessemer City High School called 911 about a bomb threat.
A person has called the building today and said we have explosives buried on the ground at Bessemer City High School.
20 summer school students were sheltering in the lunchroom when droves of police, firefighters, emergency medical personnel, and canine teams descended upon the Gaston County School. No bomb was found. Police quickly traced the call to 30-year-old Dylan Ledford. He was a homeless man with a long record of drug crimes, larcenies, and even cyber solicitation of sex with a minor. An ex-girlfriend helped police locate him. She told them Ledford had been in and out of jails and mental institutions, according to the police report. Ledford was arrested for making a false threat of mass violence against a school. A psychological evaluation performed later found he appeared to be suffering from psychosis associated with schizophrenia, including delusions and paranoia. We meet Ledford a few weeks later in the Gaston County Jail. He's an intense man with a wiry build and messy blonde hair. He says he's being terrorized by artificial intelligence, and he wants me to warn people about the plot.
They're social engineering people with the names and Elon Musk, and they're basically using linguistic anthropology to name the people and tracking. They're tracking explosives, they're tracking international crime, and I've been tracking it myself.
Ledford says he's repeatedly tried to report the terrorist conspiracy. He's frustrated that no one is listening to his delusions. He says he's called half a dozen federal agencies, including the NSA and the Secret Service, but he says they can't stop the electronic attacks. It's a confusing narrative, and Ledford gets upset when he thinks I won't warn people.
You doing all right? You good? Okay.
That's Gaston Jail Chief Becky Cawthron.
You kind of encountered maybe just a smidgen of what we encounter with numerous 50, 60 people a day that have some kind of mental health illness.
She estimates half of the inmates here have psychiatric problems. The jail has a clinical social worker for mental health on site, so it offers more care than most. But Cawthron says it's not enough.
Some of these people need way more treatment than what we can give them inside a detention facility. This is not a long-term facility, but it has become for some people with mental health illnesses.
Ledford's still in jail awaiting trial almost a year later. A court decided he's too ill to understand the charges against him or to assist in his own defense. He needs psychiatric care just so he can be well enough to go to trial. His attorney, Veronica Monteleone, was the one who requested the evaluation.
The more you speak with him and you really listen to the content of what he's saying, the more concerned you become about what exactly is going on with him and his mental capacity.
The evaluation was performed soon after Ledford was booked last July. It found Ledford was incapable to stand trial, but the DA wanted another evaluation, and it took 7 months for that to happen. The second evaluator agreed with the first, but the wait meant it was February before Ledford finally got on the wait list for a state hospital bed. That long lag time isn't unusual. WFAE's investigation found half of all inmates wait more than 363 days for a bed in Western North Carolina, where Ledford is. Those waits aren't good for inmates with mental health problems, Cawthron says. They're also hard on detention officers.
They're sitting here for months and months and months waiting to get in that facility. And then you have officers who are having to tend to people with some serious mental health issues that are sometimes combative, assaultive, and out of control, and we're trying to control them.
At one point, Ledford was placed in protective custody, his lawyer says. That meant he was in isolation. The reasons for protective custody are confidential, but it's frequently necessary when inmates are suicidal or at risk of harm from others. But isolating mentally ill inmates for a long time can worsen their health, warns the American College of Correctional Physicians. And then officers have to deal with them.
You have to know how to be able to speak to them without them feeling threatened. You have to learn how to be able to speak with people at different mental health illnesses differently.
Cawthron staff gets crisis intervention training so they can de-escalate tense situations. Last year, they also started to take classes in what's called verbal judo to help officers keep control in difficult situations. So they learn when to step forward or move back. Cawthron says she's learned the hard way.
I have had inmates that were mentally ill that mixed up milk and their feces and stirred up in a cup and then corner me with it. I've had urine thrown on me. I've had my nose broken. So, yeah, I've seen a lot of things happen with people that are very aggressive.
Locking up inmates with mental illness can make the work of deputies more dangerous, according to research from a national police forum. It also increases the risk that police will use force. Eddie Caldwell of the North Carolina Sheriff's Association says fewer people would end up in jail if mental health care was more available. His group lobbied state lawmakers to expand Medicaid so more people will have access to care.
The sheriffs feel like if folks got the care they needed outside the jail, many of them would not commit the crimes that bring them into the jail, or if they did commit the crimes, they would not be in as bad of a physical or mental shape when they get in the jail.
Locking up people with mental illness has other costs, too.
It also ties up a lot of bed space. In some counties, the jails are overcrowded or full, and a lot of those beds are being occupied by folks that need mental health treatment.
That's expensive. Caldwell estimates North Carolina jails spend $70 to $100 a night to house each inmate. It costs a lot more if an inmate needs hospitalization. County taxpayers pick up the tab. And there's another expense. When someone goes to the ER in crisis and needs inpatient care, officers have to drive them to a hospital with an open bed. Since there's a shortage of mental health beds, many officers end up driving patients clear across the state. Gaston deputies drove 83,000 miles taking people to hospitals in 2021 alone, according to records Cawthron provided. That took 3,000 hours of her deputy's time. In March, after years of debating the issue, North Carolina passed a law expanding Medicaid eligibility to those who earn less than 138% of the federal poverty level. That's $20,000 a year. Expansion will go into effect if and when North Carolina enacts a budget. Caldwell says he's optimistic, but he's waiting to see the details, and he's staying in touch with North Carolina's Secretary of Health and Human Services, Cody Kinsley. You've said to Secretary Kinsley, we need some help here.
Absolutely. Before the Medicaid bill was passed, said it to him again on the day of the bill signing at the governor's mansion.
But the debate in Raleigh obscures another cost that's not talked about much. Officers' health is affected by the jail environment, too.
We can get either treatment or alternate placement for the folks that need to be in a medical facility or need medical care, mental health care, that will lessen the burden on the day-to-day detention officer who has to be there for a 12-hour shift.
Ms. Lynette, you want your lunch? No lunch?
Sergeant Monica Becton takes us down a corridor of female inmates with mental illness to show what that 12-hour shift is like. The women are alone in their cells 24 hours a day. They're isolated because they're a danger to themselves or the officers, Becton says. There's an intense smell of urine. Many refuse to use a bathroom. Some smear feces on themselves, Becton says. She thinks it's what mental institutions used to be like.
You read about the mental facilities where people had to lay in their, you know, their feces and their urine and just the echoing of the screams and everything. That's what it reminds me of.
Becton says she carries a heavy weight on her shoulders, trying to make sure the inmates don't hurt themselves. And it makes her angry that they can't go to a hospital like they used to be able to do when she started work 24 years ago. It's hard not to carry that home with her, and family can't always understand.
And I just need to go outside and be by myself for a little bit because I don't want to talk about it again. So it's very hard on families to not be able to understand, because until you walk in the shoes of a detention officer, you can't fathom what we go through every day.
There isn't much data on detention officers in jails, but a California survey of prison officers found many become depressed or anxious as a result of the job. They're also more likely to become suicidal. Officers see a lot of bad things, Cawthron says. Dealing with inmates who really need to be in a mental hospital is one of them.
There's a lot of sadness that you see, and it affects an officer. It affects that the way they look at the outside when they go back outside.
Cawthron says officers need a way to stop thinking about the troubled inmates they see all day long. Perhaps like Dylan Ledford, who says he started to hear voices when he was a child, before he bounced between group homes and foster families.
And you know that a lot of these people just come from broken homes or broken families, and that if they would have had a chance on the outside, that maybe things would have been a lot different for them.
Instead of sitting in the Gaston jail. For WFAE News, I'm Dana Miller-Irvin.
The series was edited by Greg Collard and Aaron Texera. Our researcher is Mona Dugani. The podcast is edited and produced by me, Eric Thiel, at WFAE in Charlotte. Fractured is a collaboration between WFAE and the PBS series Frontline through its local journalism initiative, which is funded by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.